Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 27th, 2004. Today's session number is COD 2004-01. Today's speaker is Don Coberly. The lesson for today is Summon Out the Geologist in You. That rock is nice. Don't take it for granted. Let's listen in.
There in the media ministry, we'll get going here. My first question, first off, how many people weren't at the session yesterday?
We're not.
Holy yikes! Okay.
It was, didn't get away with it.
It was a great session. It was one of the best geology sessions anybody's ever given. My name is Don Coberly. My business card says I'm a senior hydrogeologist. That means I study groundwater for a living. I work for the consulting firm that was hired back in 1996 to come and do the investigation on the mine site. So I've been coming here fairly regularly, probably 20 times since 1997, to do professional work related to the mine. I was in the portal of the mine earlier today doing some more work. Ongoing maintenance. So if you have questions, I'm not planning on doing a presentation on that, but if you have questions about the mine and how things are going in the investigation process, whenever you see me is an okay time to talk to me about that. So I'm a groundwater hydrogeologist, a senior hydrogeologist is what my business card says. I have a degree in geology and another one in geological engineering. I've been on volunteer teaching staff two or three times, and I've also done some elder hostel sessions teaching reasonably what we're talking about today, which is basic geology. The series of sessions I've called Summon Out the Geologist in You, sort of working off of the summer theme, but also something that I believe, which is that anybody can be a geologist. It's not a very complicated thing to do. It's pretty common sense. So that's the angle of attack that I take. This session is called That Rock is Nice, Don't Take it for Granted. And I know it's so hokey a title that I just have to fess up to it being mine. So I can't blame anybody else for it. That's a thing that my nephews would call grandpa humor. So there's a series of five sessions that I think sort of head towards the session on Saturday, which is a hike on the 10-mile Falls Trail. There are some good geologic stops there that we'll plan on taking a couple hours and going and doing that. So yesterday we talked a little bit about rocks. Today we're going to do a quick review of yesterday and talk more about rocks. Wednesday and Friday we're going to talk about sort of basic geologic concepts and then go on the hike on Friday, or on Saturday, excuse me. There's no session on Thursday because of Jubilee. My assumptions about you being here are that you have some interest in geology. I mean, maybe you're coming to session because somebody's guilted you into doing it, right? And you'd rather go to this one than that one. Or, you know, for some other reason, or else you're interested in geology. And my thinking is, if you're interested in geology, unless you live in Holden Village and are planning on never moving, you're going to do your geology somewhere else, right? We could do a really thorough study of Railroad Creek and learn it really well. And then if you went someplace else that was just like Railroad Creek, you could tell everybody else about it. But there aren't that many places like that. So I assume that if you're interested in doing geology further, that you're going to go back to your home, wherever that is, in Minnesota or Oregon or California, or I think those are the only places that people can come here from. And if you're interested in geology, you're going to do it there. So what I hope to do is, through these sessions, give you some basic geologic concepts and ideas so that when you go back to wherever you go back to, you can take those ideas and, you know, apply them to the world that you live in. I have a series of books here called the Roadside Geology Series. These are widely available at at chain bookstores that you should never go to, like Borders or Barnes & Noble. Go to your local independent bookseller and buy there. But there, I've got Washington, Oregon, Colorado, and Arizona with me. There's another book here from the same, reasonably the same series called Northwest Exposures that talks about the entire Northwest, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana. There are, I don't know if there is one of these for every state. There are probably 30 that I know of, and if you go to Amazon.com and look, and then go by your local independent bookseller, you can find one for your state. The point of these is, if you're going to drive from here back to Spokane, you can look in this book, and it's set up along a road map to say, oh, highway whatever it is from Wenatchee to Spokane, it's page 95. So you go to page 95, and there's a map that shows the road that you're going to take, and a basic sketch of the geology, of the geologic map of the areas that you're going to be going through. And I think this series is a really good series of neither too simple nor too complicated. Right? It's in that good range of, you don't have to have a lot of geology to be able to understand what's going on. So what I hope is, learn some basic concepts here, take this book, go driving somewhere and get more interested in geology. When you go back home, there are other resources that you have. The local community college has a geology teacher in it somewhere. I'm confident of that. And you can sign up for a quarter of geology and learn more about it and go way more in depth than we will. So, I have a thesis written down on a piece of paper in my carry-all here that talks about what I think the basic idea should be here. And again, I think if you can't summarize something in about three sentences, it's way too complicated. My thesis is, at its essence, geology is an observational science. It is based on observations of rocks, landforms, and the relationship of rock units with one another. Once observations have been made, it is then possible to make interpretations or advance hypotheses about the geologic makeup and history of an area. That's not bad for reading from the backside. And I'll put this up here. This will, tomorrow, since we'll be here again, I'll have it up there and we won't have to go through that. Geology is an observational science. It's not like math, which I think is a computational science, or physics or chemistry, which are experimental sciences, right? To do geology, you go out and you see it. You go out and you look at it. And you, as we talked about a little bit yesterday, you feel it and taste it and smell it and things like that. But mostly you look at it. So we go out, we're going to identify rocks, or we're going to look at rock units, and we put them on a map if you're a professional or if you get really interested in it. And then you start trying to figure out, based on where the rocks are, is there some relationship between them? So, yesterday we started with talking about there are three major rock types. Igneous rocks, metamorphic rocks, and sedimentary rocks. We spent most of the day yesterday talking about sedimentary rocks. We'll talk about the igneous and metamorphic rocks today. The reason we spent yesterday talking about sedimentary rocks is that about 70% of the rocks that we can see at the Earth's surface are sedimentary rocks. So my idea is start with, what is it Stephen Covey says, first things first, right? Let's start with the biggest piece of the pie first and study that in the hopes that the odds will be in our favor and we'll know more about the thing that we need to know the most about. Unfortunately, here we are in the Railroad Creek Valley where there are no sedimentary rocks. It's all igneous and metamorphic rocks. So today we'll learn more about the rocks that we can actually see around here. We define sedimentary rocks. This is about a 10-minute summary of yesterday. We define sedimentary rocks as thinking about sediment as being a solid material that's moved by a fluid. I use the example of coffee grounds being moved by coffee from the big coffee urn into my coffee cup. or sedimenting wine. If you get really fancy bottled wine, apparently there's a little sediment in the bottom of it. That's that material, and it gets moved into your glass by the fluid of the wine. Water is clearly, I think, the most obvious fluid that we think of. The other fluids that we can think of are air. So that if you go up on the tailings pile right now, you can see sediment being moved by air, right? Being blown across, it's called dust. Or if you're in the Sahara where the winds are blowing farther, faster, harder, now you see sand dunes that get moved by the air moving the sand grains. We also talked about ice, especially in the form of glaciers, which can transport solid material, right? And then when the ice melts, the solid material drops out. We came up with a couple other ideas yesterday, a couple other things that I hadn't thought of like a landslide. That kind of works as a fluid to transport the solid material, and then as it runs out of energy, it sort of dumps down. Or the same thing with a volcanic gas. Some volcanic explosions have a gas that comes out the side and runs down, screams down the side of the volcano, and blows up and churns up stuff and collects it up and deposits it somewhere else. Within sedimentary rocks, there are two kinds, clastic rocks, C-L-A-S-T, clast, which is just another word for a grain or a particle. And then chemical sedimentary rocks, like limestone, is by far the most familiar. That's where, out in the ocean, small multicellular animals live and die, and their skeleton is made of calcium carbonate. So as they live, they build this skeleton, and then they die, and this calcium carbonate filters down to the bottom of the ocean and gets stacked up until there's enough of it to weigh and press down on it and turns it from just sort of these grains into a rock. That turning of sediment into a rock is called lithification. Lithify means to turn to rock. We talked about the chemical sedimentary rocks really briefly, but focused on the clastic sedimentary rocks because there are things that you can tell from those. If you have a sedimentary rock, I'm sorry I didn't bring any down with me, they're up at the mine museum. We talked about looking at the sedimentary rock as being sort of an indicator as to the geology of the area that it comes from. I used the example of if I wanted to know all of the rock types that are up in the basin from here on up, you could either go hiking and hike up on all the ridges and have your hammer with you and bang off pieces and throw them in your backpack, and it'd take you 2 or 3 weeks to make a big circuit here, and you'd be out all night, every night, sleeping in the ice and snow and cold. Or you could go down to Railroad Creek and fool around in the creek looking at the rocks that are there. Let the creek do the work for you, right? Because of all of the areas up there, whenever anything erodes, it comes down into the creek, and sooner or later it gets transported down here. So using the sedimentary rock or the sediment that we see right there can give us a clue as to what might be further up the valley, and we don't have to go do all that work to get to it. And in fact, in the work, I've done some work overseas at a mine site in Indonesia, that ore body was found precisely by that method, where the first thing that someone would do as they were going out to do this exploration work is they'd hike up all the creeks. And when they come to a creek, and here's a fork that goes up this way, they stop right at the mouth, and they collect up a bag full of sediment and put it in their backpack and take it back to the office and do some chemical techniques to it to burn it all up and see what's left. Ah, nothing here. You go to the next creek, nothing there. You go to the next creek, nothing there. You go to the next creek, and there's a whole bunch of copper in that sediment. Well, then that's the place you go up to, and you start looking further up that drainage. And now you come to the next fork, and you take samples from both sides, and one of them's good and one of them's not so good. Well, you know, you got to keep going that way. So that's the way, at the first level, that a geochemical exploration is done, is by looking at the sediments. Let the creek do all the work for you. The second thing we talked about sedimentary rocks was looking at the rock itself and trying to make a guess of was this rock deposited reasonably near the source or reasonably far away from the source. We use two characteristics of the rock to help give us a guide there. When a rock falls up in Copper Basin right now and comes down and it's a fresh new rock fall, all of the fragments of rock are all different sizes, right? It doesn't, you don't just fall, all the pieces that fall aren't all the same size. You got Volkswagen bus size pieces, and you got handful size pieces, and you got sand grains, and you got silt grains, and everything, right? Boom, it all falls down there. So it's all different sizes and shapes. As that material gets transported, it comes down into Railroad Creek over tens or hundreds of thousands of years, and finally gets transported down to Lake Chelan, and what's happened to it. In general, you're not transporting Volkswagen size bus pieces, you're transporting this size to sand grain size, right? So, and what's the other thing that we notice as we get into the creek here or as we move further downstream? The rocks become a little bit more rounded, or in fact a lot more rounded, right? That angularity is the technical term for, is it sharp and angular or is it rounded? And there are subgrades there, and the idea is the more angular the rock is that you see, probably the closer you are to the source. My analogy is that the environment is the world's biggest rock tumbler, right? That everything about the erosive processes is trying to tear the mountains down as they're being lifted up. And as time goes on, the rock from up in Copper Basin to it gets to Lake Chelan, it spends more time in the rock tumbler. So all those angular edges get knocked off and it gets more rounded. And as well, you leave the biggest pieces behind because nothing can move them. Once, if you fall, if you have a Volkswagen van-sized piece of rock, there are no rainstorms that we've had in the last 500 years that are big enough to move that. So there's this winnowing process and this homogenizing process, and we call, in geology terms, we call that sorting. So angular fragments that are poorly sorted are, you generally think of, is this in line with being fairly common sense? Those are fairly close to where they originally came from. They haven't spent a lot of time in the rock tumbler. As you get to the other end of the spectrum, stuff has been banged down the stream day at a time, week at a time, month at a time, and by the time it gets down to Lake Chelan, it's all reasonably rounded, and it's all pretty much the same particles. By saying near the source or far away from the source, does not imply that we can tell it's 2 miles away or 5 miles away or 6 miles away. It's, are we close within tens or twenties of miles, or are we 1,000 miles away? The last thing we talked about sedimentary rocks was the energy and the consistency of the environment of deposition. We talked, again, thinking about our rock fall up in Copper Basin. The energy of that is really high energy, a rock fall, right? It falls on you and kills you. And it's not very consistent. We don't have a rock fall every day. At the other end of the spectrum, I use the example of the beach. The beach is the same every day, right? You can go to the beach yesterday and there's waves breaking, and they break at 8 waves a minute. 8 waves a minute, 480 waves an hour. 24 times 480, I'm already, it's already, the math is too much for me, times 100,000 years, and that's pretty regular. And so what I showed at the end, or partway through yesterday, were these jars, and I'll pass them around today. This is sand grains that you can find and mine in eastern Wyoming, where for 100 or 200 million years, there was the edge of the beach. And so that material, all is what's left there is all the resistant stuff, and it's also extremely rounded. This stuff hasn't been washed very much, and there's been no additional mechanical stuff done on this that the environment hasn't already done. So this is at the very other end of the spectrum of day after day, year after year, ten thousands of years of that getting pounded, and that's what's left. So this would be something that's old and resistant, and has come from that very consistent environment of deposition. The other end of that spectrum is Copper Basin rockfall. Or the other example I used yesterday was, I have a picture of a rock that we'll probably see new tomorrow from Indonesia that is sort of the opposite of that. The rock is a big big boulder that has in it all sorts of angular fragments of different kinds of rock of different sizes, and it's all angular. The complete opposite sort of that world, and what I believe, and I think I'm right about it, is that that rock was from a volcanic eruption. This hot gas that we're talking about comes out the top of the vent and starts flowing down the side of the mountain, side of the volcano, and it's so energetic that it just rips up the pieces of the rock that it's moving along and incorporates them into this thing that's superheated at first, and as you move miles away, it starts to cool down into sort of a goo, and it's still ripping things up, and it's moving at 60 miles an hour, which is fantastic in the geologic realm. Right? A glacier moves 3 feet a year, so 60 miles an hour is orders of magnitude larger than that, and it finally cools somewhere and solidifies and sits down. So, angular stuff is energetic stuff, and it's not very frequent. When we find those jars of rock, of sand, that's something that's very repetitive, very... And the beach, when you think about a hot or a rough day at the beach or a not very rough day at the beach, maybe one of those is 10 times rougher than the other, right? That's not a whole lot in the geologic time frame. The difference between the energy of today up in Copper Basin, which is zero, and the energy of a rockfall, which is 1,000 or 1,000,000, whatever, I don't know how we would measure that, but today nothing happened up there. The day of the rockfall, everything happens. So those are the kinds of clues that we would look at in looking at sedimentary rocks. As I said earlier, unfortunately, we don't have any sedimentary rocks here to look at. But if you go back to wherever it is you go back to, odds are, just generally 70% of the time, that you're going to be looking at a sedimentary rock. So that's yesterday. And let's move on to igneous rocks and metamorphic rocks. Another highly technical holdout to show you here. Three types of rocks. Sedimentary rocks, we talked about clastic and chemical rocks. Igneous rocks are either extrusive or intrusive, and then in a little bit we'll talk about metamorphic rocks. Igneous rocks are rocks that have solidified from a molten state. That's the simplest way to think of them. There is some no different than if you have a pan of, what's the candy that you make by melting sugar? Sorry?
I think of peanut butter.
Okay. You have this stuff that's heated, and then somehow the heat source goes away in the peanut brittle, you turn the heat off and it cools down. And now you've got this solidified stuff. And it's got chunks in it, and sometimes rock does the same thing. So let's do a quick thought experiment. We have three of these pans of, let's use the chemical, let's be a little more scientific about it, and say we've got these three pans of boiling water and we pour something in them that forms crystals, like calcium, copper sulfate or something like that. And of course, boiling water can hold more stuff, more concentrated stuff than cool water can, right? So we pour this stuff in and we stir it up and we've got these three pans of stuff. In the first pan, what we do is we run it out and we put it in the freezer. In the second pan, we just turn off the heat. In the third pan, we turn down from 212 degrees to 211 degrees. Then we come back the next day and we turn it down to 210 degrees and then 209, and like 7 months from now we're down to zero, right? Think about, or the question is, what is the crystal size going to be in each of those pans? As things cool, if there are little bits of places where the crystal can start to form, you'll start to form crystals. My belief, although I've never done this experiment, is that in that first pan that we threw in the freezer straight away, if we can see any crystals at all, they'll be incredibly small, right? There's just no time for any crystallization to take place. The second pan, the one we just took off the heat and it cooled at its own rate, we're going to find smaller crystals, bigger crystals than we did in the freezer, And then the one that we let cool down very, 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 very slowly, we're going to find fairly large crystals in there. Is there any? Go ahead.
Now you're talking about a solute in a solid.
Yep.
Something that dissolved.
Yep.
Now, what if you melt something?
If you melt something,
and cool it at three different rates.
At the time that that's liquid, isn't that essentially the same thing? It's all.
That's my question.
I think it's precisely the same thing.
And you got one phase and two phase on the other.
And when you melt a rock, if we would take this piece of rock that you have in your hand and heat it up and keep it compressed so nothing got away from it, now we just have the liquid rock, right? We have the liquid, a melted rock, and then we do exactly the same thing. And on, I think my belief is we would find precisely the same thing. So the whole point of the experiment, the thought experiment, is when we see an igneous rock, which is the thing that you all have, associate the grain, the crystal size, to how quickly did it cool, and then from how quickly did it cool to how deep was it in the earth when it cooled. We have small crystals. We think of, generally, that's an extrusive rock. It's the definition of extrusive rock is it's extruded at the surface, right? The idea of that is if something in toothpaste gets extruded from a toothpaste tube, it gets pumped out of the toothpaste tube. So the Hawaiian volcanoes are extrusive rocks. The flood basalts, the Columbia River basalts in Oregon, are the same way. They came up to the surface through vents and came out and spread over the landscape, right? So if you go to Hawaii and you look at one of those rocks and you look at it in hand specimen, you can't see any crystals. And you take your hand lens, which is geologist's term for magnifying glass. It's a portable magnifying glass, but if you want to do geology and you got a magnifying glass, you're already there. And you look at it through there and you still can't see any crystals. That's because that stuff came up yesterday and solidified today. And one day in geologic time is nothing. On the other hand, what we have here are rocks that have crystals that are big enough that we can see, and so are at the first, most broad way of thinking of it, my interpretation would be that these crystals have cooled, this melt cooled somewhat more slowly. You can't cool slowly at the surface. Melted rock is at, I don't know, 1200 degrees C or 600 degrees C. It's pretty hot, and so when you bring it to the surface at 10 degrees C or 15 degrees C, it cools very quickly and you don't find these crystals. So what this implies to me is that this rock came up from down deeper in the crust very slowly and cooled very, very slowly and cooled and solidified at some depth, and has since, through further uplift, gotten closer to the surface, and the stuff that was above it got eroded off, and now we see it at the surface. When we talk about stuff, intrusive rocks, shallow intrusive rocks or deep intrusive rock, it's not like this rock came to within 50 feet of the surface or 100 yards of the surface. It came to within a mile of the surface or 2 miles of the surface. Okay? And then through further uplift got brought to the surface, and now we can see it. And this is very similar. This is local from down just above where the switchbacks are. So my first guess, I don't know this for certain, but I assume that this has solidified at some depth of some miles, and through further uplift has been brought up to where we can now see it, which we'll do on our hike, or use it for riprap along Railroad Creek, which is what that is currently being used for, and where I went and busted a big piece off and busted it up to use here. So we have small crystalline rock, we have large crystalline rock. What do we do if we find a piece of this stuff that has both large and small crystals in it? And if you go up to the mine museum, you'll see some things like that that have this general appearance, and yet there are two or three fairly large crystals in it. Any guesses or any hypotheses on what that shift is?
Well, something hot was pushed up to another layer, which was the lower layer trapped the upper layer.
That's one idea that we call that when that happens. We call that thing that's trapped inside a different thing. My interpretation of that is something started cooling very slowly and allowed those large crystals to form. And then for some reason, a fracture or a fault or something like that came to the surface much more rapidly. So you have half of the melt generating these large crystals as this thing is moving slowly, and now there's some vent to the surface, and boom, it comes up the rest of the way, or it comes very close to the surface, and those large crystals now have this finer grain stuff or finer crystalline stuff around it.
Are there different chemicals?
Go ahead.
Different chemicals in the rock, though, that would crystallize at different sizes, just naturally, even if they crystallized at the same rate?
Not, I got to think about that for a second, but I think in that case, those differences would be reasonably small, not from this to this.
Sometimes is it not due to thermal conditions, a circular raising and falling of rock in a circular motion?
That happens in the Earth. The current model of the Earth that we use is a three-part model. The crust, which is the part that we can see and drill into, which is hard, brittle. The mantle, which is the part I think you're talking about, which is viscous but still flowy. Can I use that term? So and it's those convection currents in that, and then the core, the very center, there are actually two parts to that we think. There is an outer core and an inner core. The inner core is solid. Even though it's at a huge temperature, there's just so much stuff on top of it that it's so compressed that it acts as a solid. And then a liquid part around that. But those convection cells in the mantle are what drive plate tectonics, which is the sort of big theory of geology in the moment. And if under that circumstance, what happens if we have this composition of stuff and it's coming up very slowly through the Earth, and I don't know why it would be that it would go back down again. Maybe the geologic regime changes and now more stuff gets laid on top of it and it gets pushed deeper, it would remelt a little bit, right? And you would lose, I'd have to think about what happens in that case. That's a fairly, a little bit more involved. So, again, at the broadest level, small crystals close to the surface, deeper crystals cooled, bigger crystals cooled deeper. Some of both, big crystals and small crystals, and now you have some of both. Cooled slowly for a while and then came to the surface. What you're talking about, and we'll see this probably tomorrow, is if you have a rock that's some other kind of rock that's in place and you have molten rock that comes in along a crack or a fissure. Just what I was talking about with the volcano in Indonesia, where that stuff is coming so fast it rips up some of the ground, this is what happens as well. If you inject some molten material into a fracture in cool rock, every now and again that stuff will just shear off a little piece from the edge of the crack and incorporate it into this jet of now cooling material, and you'll see that it's called a xenolith. But that stuff will be represent it, you'll look at this fragment of material in the vein, and you'll look at the host rock, and it's the same stuff, right? So you've just you've taken a piece, you've sheared it off, and incorporated it. So you're mentioning chemistry. I want to talk about chemistry for about 10 minutes, and I'm not doing this to punish you. I promise. I'm doing this more because I think. Again, my if you walk away from here with one thing at all from any of the sessions that we go to, is that geology is pretty common sense, and it's not all that complicated. I really believe that. And it, every now and again it comes up that someone has a question about the chemistry, and here was a question about the chemistry. Does the chemistry of a melt somehow reflect or mandate the sizes of the crystals? And I think that's more a cooling rate thing than it is a chemistry thing. And somewhere along the line, after having a chemistry question asked to me, I got this idea. If I could have one hard copy to look at. You two guys know each other well enough to share it? I got this idea of a big Lego set of Lego blocks that each of the Lego blocks would represent an element. Is there a chemist here who can tell me how many elements there are currently that we've discovered? Like 115 or 120, is that? 117? Okay, 117. So there's 117 elements out there. Here's this, again, this is my idea of, if you want to use elements to build minerals, which is what you make rocks out of, and you want to buy it, you want to get a kit to buy these, to make minerals with, and you buy a 1,000-piece kit, this is how many pieces of each different element will be in there. And what this shows is, if you can remember 8 elements, oxygen, silicon, aluminum, iron, calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium, right? Those are the top 8 sellers on my list. You know 98.6% of all of chemistry that is possible for crustal rocks. Now, it's a little different if we would take the entire Earth as a whole. We think that center stuff, the core, is iron and nickel. So, but this is the stuff that we can physically get to, the crustal rocks, both the continental crust that we see here or the oceanic crust that we see under the oceans. Oxygen, silicon, aluminum, iron, calcium, magnesium, sodium, potassium. 98.6% of the mass of the planet that we can get to is made up of those 8 things. Right? It's not all that hard. I have a list here. Oh, before I get to that, the other point that I want to make, if you get a 1,000-piece kit, this is what you get. You get 466 blocks of oxygen and 277 blocks of silicon. And you get all of these. You get one hydrogen, and in here you got 994 blocks, so there's still 6 blocks left to fill out your 1,000-piece set. And that's where it's like getting baseball cards. When I was growing up, you get baseball cards and you get like 6 copies of some guy who was no good before you get Ernie Banks. Right. Or if you're a Cardinals fan, a Lou Brock or something like that. Anyway, on the side of the box, it talks about what other things might be in there. And this is just simply a listing of the crustal composition by percentage. So that's all the stuff you're sure to get, and then you may get a barium or a strontium or a sulfur or a carbon, and you're almost, the bottom line almost certainly doesn't contain everything else, including lithium, boron, silver, cadmium, tin, lead, zinc, copper. Where's copper at? It's in the probably. So does this make sense at all? I mean, as I was walking down the hill today for the second time from the portal and thinking about, what I was thinking about was Ben and Jerry's ice cream. What I think happens at Ben and Jerry's is they have the one big vat of ice cream base that's all the same, and then they spoon a little bit out and they put some pistachios in it and a little green food coloring, and now it's pistachio nut or whatever it's called, and they take, I see geology, and particularly these igneous rocks that we're talking about, as being precisely the same. 98.6% of it is what I just said. oxygen, silicon, aluminum, iron, calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium. And every now and again, you get a little lithium in there, and it turns a little bit pink. Or you get a little, and every great once in a while, you get some copper, and it gets concentrated, and we build a mine there. This helps explain why there aren't mines everywhere on the planet, right? Because copper is fairly rare to find. In here, I have one piece, additional piece of a rock that's fairly similar to the one that you have, only it's got a bunch of pink crystals in it, and you can pass this around and look at it. And my belief is, if we would cut a piece of that up and cut a piece of what you have up and melt them down and do a chemical analysis of them, to 99% they're going to be exactly the same. There's going to be a little bit of something in the one that isn't in the other that gives that rock the pink color. So, if you can remember eight elements, you already know all the chemistry you need to know about geology, the most of it.
Carbon, carbonate. I mean, limestone is a calcium carbonate, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
There's an awful lot of that in the Rocky Mountains.
Yes, there is. And there's maybe a little bit in the sediment all through the Midwest. And so,
and really not that much.
Really not that much. What I have written down here, just to frighten you even further a little bit, is the chemical formula of a bunch of the most common minerals that we find. And when you first look at it, it looks really intimidating. If you would see this in a book, you'd shut the book and go to the other session, right? Because this is way too complicated. But when you look at it, quartz is something that everybody's familiar with, I would assume. Those jars that I've got are quartz sand. That's the chemical formula of quartz. Silicon oxygen. The other things that make up those rocks that we have here are these things called plagioclase and orthoclase. Those are called feldspars. Is that something, a word that people are familiar with at all? Well, what do you got? Oxygen, silicon, aluminum. Numbers 1, 2, and 3 on your list, I think. And then sodium and calcium. And as you get through, you look at these, and the formulas get more complicated in the stoichiometry, if you're a chemist, which is how many of this go with how many of that, with how many it all fits together. But there's nothing on this list except for those eight things that we've mentioned, that I've said a bunch of times, plus this OH, which is a hydroxy, which is still one of the things on your list, oxygen. So it's the same thing put together in a bunch of different ways. But the basic chemistry of the planet is not all that complicated. That's the point I'm trying to make. And it's simpler than you think. So.
This may be kind of a side question, so you can blow it off. But, you know, they're talking about carbon dating and everything. So I guess I was under the impression that, you know, almost everything had carbon in it. And so they're using that as a foundation for dating. Is that not true? Or is that something totally
different? Carbon dating is usable to about 50,000 years ago. And you don't, for geologic specimens, there are other things that are used. Uranium, it's more radioactive decay. With carbon is much more useful for artifact level things. It's only good to about 50,000 years ago. So if you want to try to figure out the carbon date on some hot shard that you find in a fire, you carbon date the stick in the fire and assume that the hot shard is the same age as, you know, the stick. But with geologic time, the age of the Earth being 4.6 billion years, carbon dating is good for this last little smidgen of time. So it's useful in archaeology. And in real near-surface stuff, if we wanted to go out and figure out right here at the mine site, if we find different levels of terraces up the valley, and we want to date those are all less than 12,000 years ago, because that's the last time the glacier retreated. Now we might try to do some carbon dating and see if we can figure out something that way. If we're trying to figure out the different, or the rocks that we'll see on the hike, that are 20 million years or 75 million years old. You can't use carbon dating on that. And those things being coming from a melt, if there was any carbon in it at the start, it got burned off. So it's not useful. Okay. Was there one other yet? Go ahead.
Do moon rocks or any rocks for that matter that enter the Earth from outer space contain the major eight?
They have a somewhat of a different composition, and there are two main kinds of meteorites. Stony meteorites and iron nickel meteorites, I think, is the first. And the iron and nickel ones have iron and nickel. The stony ones have more of this silicon and oxygen in it. So there are two major categories that have been found. One other thing I want to talk about the chemistry, just to maybe make you think that there's some utility to it at all, is the chemistry has an impact on the viscosity of the material. The more of the more iron and manganese you find in it, the more viscous the fluid is. And that's also what, in the darker colors, these things kind of down here at the bottom are more dark colored. These two micas, muscovite is a light colored. People know what mica is. It's the real platy, sheeny kind of stuff. This is light, and this is black. What's the difference between the two? Magnesium and iron are present in this biotite. When you get to a rock like the Hawaiian volcanoes, there's a lot more magnesium and iron in those. That fluid is very viscous. So when you look at a cross-section of a Hawaiian volcano, it's pretty low. If you take a cross-section of the Hawaiian Islands, with that being the water, here's the top of the volcano, it's very low lying, right? That's because that material is so viscous as it comes out, it flows out and goes a long ways. It can't stand up very high. Where you look at Mount Hood or Mount St. Helens before May of 81, Mount Hood is much more like that. That's because the material, the chemistry of the material is much more silicious. That stuff is much more viscous, and when it explodes, it can stand up higher. The other thing that comes out of that is, you never really hear very much about catastrophic volcanic eruptions in Hawaii, right? It's because the stuff comes up over the edge and kind of flows out, and as long as you don't have your back turned, you can get away from it. Whereas Mount St. Helens blows and whatever it was, 60 people got killed. Those explosions are much more eruptive, much more energetic. I think of it as either having water in my toothpaste tube so that when I squirt on the toothpaste tube, it comes out real easy, or having oatmeal in there. Right? If you want to fool with somebody and fill up their toothpaste tube with oatmeal, and you're squeezing on it really hard, and all of a sudden it explodes and it's all funny, but think of volcanoes being precisely the same way. That those volcanic eruptions that are, and again, it's related back to the chemistry of it. So that's my, I'm hoping I didn't kill anybody with the chemistry talk, but I see it. And another thing that comes up is looking at water. Water flow, waterfalls, and what is it? It's H2O plus a little bit of carbonate in it because it's falling through the atmosphere. And it hits the ground. What is it that makes up hard water? Calcium, magnesium, right? Your water goes and it flows through the ground, the stuff, the soil and the rock, and it picks up calcium and magnesium. It doesn't pick up silica because silica is not very reactive. And then you run it through your water softener, which is rock salt, which knocks that calcium and magnesium back out and softens the water. All right, we talked about igneous rocks. We talked about crystal sizes being the thing that we think about the most and giving us an idea as to whether it cooled at the surface or cooled at depth. The last kind of rock to talk about is metamorphic rock, and we have 11 minutes to do it. Metamorphic in geology means, or metamorphism in geology means precisely what it does everywhere else. Metamorphose means to change, right? I think of the caterpillar and the butterfly being the change. Metamorphic rock is a rock that used to be some other kind of rock that then got changed. And what are the things, what are the physical characteristics anywhere here on Earth or near the surface that can change very much? And the two that we think of in geology are pressure and temperature. If you have the Indian continent running into the bottom underside of Asia very slowly through plate tectonics, that's compression, right? That's pressure. And so those two big things push on each other and you get the Himalayan mountains. The other thing that can change is as we would pile more material on top of something and it would sink down into the crust a little bit, the temperature changes. As you go from the surface, if you go into a mine that's 1,000 feet deep, I forget what you gain, 3 degrees per 1,000 feet or something like that, because you're getting closer to the center of the planet where there's more heat and it's trapped and it's dissipating slowly. So as you pile material on top of whatever your rock is, you can heat it up. Once you pile enough on it, it remelts, and now it's not a metamorphic rock anymore, it's a molten rock, and now it's going to be an igneous rock next week or the week after that. So there's the rock cycle that sort of each of the pieces can become another piece through time. If we have an igneous rock, which we'll see on Saturday on the hike, every time it rains and stuff comes across that rock, now that rock is in the process of becoming a sedimentary rock, right? It's the sediment that's going down the hill, that's going down into Railroad Creek. Have enough material, rather than going into Lake Chelan, it goes out into the ocean off the coast, and now it gets lithified, and now that sediment becomes a sedimentary rock, and maybe it gets buried deep enough that it starts to remelt a little bit, and now it's a metamorphic rock, and then it remelts completely, and it's an igneous rock. And it comes back up to the surface, it gets eroded, and it's a sediment. So, the two things we can think about are pressure and temperature. If you think about pressure, we can either think about just adding weight on top of something, and what that does is just sort of make it denser, right? If you add more weight, you smash it down even further and you make it denser. I have a piece of shale here, which is oceanic mud. It's the stuff that goes out deep into the ocean that flows out and gets made and gets laminated. And you'll see little leaves or little pages in here, which are the laminations. And you pile a bunch of stuff on that, and it turns from shale into slate, which we make pool table tops out of. So this is simply a weighting, an additional pressure on top of this oceanic mud changes the shale into slate. Shale is a sedimentary rock. It would be a mudstone, because that's the particle size. You put enough weight on top of it, you squeeze it a little bit, and now you make a slate out of it. And you can tell just sort of by lifting these two, this piece is a little bit smaller than this, but it's probably a little heavier. And it's denser. If, besides just pushing on something in the vertical direction, we also push on it from the side, like might be happening in the Himalayas right now, there's a thing that develops that's called schistosity, which is something we want to say very carefully. And the rock, we call a schist. Is that a familiar term to anybody at all? Okay, that's sort of the next level. The first thing you do is you just densify something. And then if you push on it from both above and on the sides, you get this schistosity, which I'll show, I'll take a picture of this around, you'll get a little waviness to it as well. It'll look a little bit like mica, that kind of shiny surface, but it's also rippled. And that's an indication, and if that's an indication of both pressure downward and probably a little crumpling as well. If you take a rug and push on it from both sides, you'll start to get little waves in the rug, right? That's a piece of schist. Let's just go with that. And finally, if you continue to push on something on that piece of schist even longer, I want to say that very carefully, it will the minerals inside the rock will sort of reorient themselves and try to, likes collect with like. What do you call that? Let me think about that. What you'll see in the end is you'll develop little bands in the rock where, it's segregated. That's the word I was trying to get to. The minerals will actually move a little bit and melt real quickly and reform, but they will reform into or with things of the same composition. It's thermodynamically more stable. That's what it's in science, that's what you call it. But what you'll see is you'll get little bands. And that's a rock called a gneiss. That's what comes from the title. And so up at the museum, you'll see a very common term called banded gneiss. And what that is a rock that started as something else and was pushed on hard enough that those minerals started to resegregate and into certain bands of like material. So whatever the basic makeup of this rock was, if you push on it long enough and hard enough and heat it up a little bit, you'll get a band that's more orthoclase, plagioclase. So you'll see a light band in there, and then you'll see a band that has more of the iron and magnesium in it. And there are some examples here where you're just starting to see the formation of these bands. And if you continue with that even longer and longer, you'll see bands, there are gneisses that you'll see in picture books that are where the bands are an inch thick or an inch and a half thick. And that shows, that again is sort of at the highest end of the pressure and temperature regime that we can do. After that, it just remelts and now you lose all of that stuff.
How do you differentiate, just as a layman and not knowing much about geology, when you see layers, your obvious first thought is sedimentary layers. How are they readily differentiated?
Usually with sedimentary layers, what you'll see is almost like if you take the edge of a book and you look at, you'll see that there are sort of these definable, regular layers. With a gneiss in particular, you'll see these wider bands, and there won't be sort of that shelving on. Is that a good word?
So it's a less distinct division.
Right. When that piece of slate comes around or shale comes around, you'll see those. It's almost you could pull them off one leaf at a time. Yeah. With a banded gneiss, you can't do that. The last thing to talk about in the last 3 minutes is if we find a piece of gneiss or even schist out in the field and we know it's connected, this is an idea that we'll talk way more about on the hike, is the first question that we'll ask ourselves, the first question I'll ask a bunch of different times is it connected to the world or not? If you find a piece of rock like this in my hand, we can't get much information of it from the orientation of it because I can change the orientation, right? Or if we're looking at the sediment out in Railroad Creek, if we're trying to find some lineation in the rock, it doesn't matter because that stuff is coming, it's moved, and tomorrow it'll be different. If we find something like the ore body that's connected to the larger world and we find some lineation, those lines that start to line up, we can measure that on the compass, and now we have another clue as to something about the greater geologic regime that we're in. Which way did the pressure come? When you find that slate or that piece of shale and you see the leaves, I think it's intuitive to me that pressure has to come from above and below, right? You don't press on something from the sides and keep it flat like that. So in this, where you, one of the things that you'll see is that the grains will almost be stretched out from our igneous rock into our metamorphic rock. That stretching to me is almost like a piece of taffy. Well, how do you get a piece of taffy stretched? You don't stretch it from the middle, you stretch it from the two ends, right? So that would be in sort of structural geology, we would think of that as being potentially an extensional, that the world is being extended in that direction. So knowing that, and knowing that that rock is tied to the rest of the world, we can measure that, and maybe it will give us some clues as we're doing our hypothesizing as to what we talk about the geologic history of an area. We can say at some point in the past we think it was being extended. So that's all I'm talking about today. We're back here tomorrow at 3:45 to talk about basic geologic concepts.